Hello and welcome back to Your Favorite Album, the podcast where we sit down with someone and say, hey, what's your favorite album? I'm your host, Adam Santiago, and joining me this time is my buddy, Jonathan Munar. Hey, buddy. Before I even say anything, I'm just going to refer to you as Johnny Moon from this point out.
That's totally fine with me.
Because that's the only way I know you.
That's right.
So I like to just start this really quick. What's your favorite album, buddy?
Yeah, well, the album I'm going to talk about today is the Smashing Pumpkins' Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness and its era and everything that they put out around the era. So it's more than just an album. It's a experience.
I love it. Multi-year
experience. Yeah.
I'm going to post a photo of this, but he's got a sealed copy of the double cassette version of this album, and it looks like a deck of magic cards, which again fits in with that era.
Yeah.
What is this I'm looking at?
So these are all of the singles that I would just obsess over about the album. So one thing that I think we're going to touch upon is the fact that Billy Corgan or the band really wrote so much material for this album. So these are just like the four singles that worth of material that they put out with incredible B-sides. I mean, like it was just this peak period for him creatively, or peak period for the band. I should keep referring to this as a band thing because it very much was a band level of output, more so than Siamese Dream ever was, I guess.
Yeah.
So they put out five singles during the era. Four of them are actual, like, had some substantial B-sides on them, and like the kinds of material that, you know, I think bands would love to just do, you know, once in their life. You know, these guys were just pumping them out over the course of really like a year, you know, 2 years, from 95 to late 96, all of this stuff came out, you know,
which is insane. I'd seen the Zero single.
Yeah.
I'd never seen 1979 or this Tonight single.
Yeah.
This is amazing. The artwork on it.
I know. I mean, it's amazing that they captured all of these experiences. Like, you know, these singles are standalone, but they did very carefully put together songs, like outtakes that they had from the album, from recording Melancholy. And at the same time, you know, maybe songs that they wrote after the recording of Melancholy, and they packaged them really beautifully next to songs off the album. So, like, you know, for 1979, for instance, you know, every B-side on 1979 sounds like it comes from the same influences. You know, they're the same kind of like musical spirit, you know, that 1979 comes from. So, you know, they did a really great job, I think, of making sure that you weren't really not just buying a single. These weren't just singles, but like they're almost like mini albums, you know, they're like EPs, and like they stand alone really well on their own. 1979 especially, like I think of everything that they did around that time, the 1979 single is the most consistent experience that they put together.
Interesting.
Sure, no,
I'm looking. I'm like, I don't think I've ever listened to any of these B-sides.
Oh man, really got to track them down. I mean, I know that like I spent so much time just trying to track down these import singles. You know, this is before you're buying things on the internet. You're going to record stores around the city. So I remember going to record stores in the Village, going to the HMV on 34th Street way back when.
Yeah, that place was great.
It was really great. And they stocked all these import CD singles. So that's how I tracked down a lot of these.
Quite a lot of Weezer imports from there.
There you go. Yeah. That's right. That's what I'm doing.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, yeah. So it was really just like this, this era of just obsessing. Like, I think millions of people would say that they obsessed over this particular album when it came out, you know, and you knew me at that time, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know how much I really was into that album. I guess I still am to a certain degree. But I mean, I think when you're a teenager, you know, and Billy Corgan is hitting this spot of like total like emo, I'm so sad type narrative, you know, it's gonna hit with any teenager, no question. You know, I was 15 when this album came out.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, I knew Siamese Dream. I liked Siamese Dream when it came out. But when this came out, you know, you're at that age, you're like, okay, I get this, you know, and I kind of want to be a part of that. Like, oh yeah, the world is so upsetting. I want to be a part of that too.
Definitely.
You know? Yeah. So.
Yeah, I was telling Pete, because we were talking about this earlier, and he was saying Melancholy was when he got out of the Smashing Pumpkins. He was like, I'm not into it. And it's like, yeah, this was an album I feel like you had to be like the right age.
That's right.
And
that's
since
right.
Since he's slightly older, it didn't work.
Yeah, I think so. Especially if you're coming off of like, if you were like in your mid-teenage years for Siamese Dream, then that was the album that you're going to stick with. And then so anything else that comes out, you're going to compare. You're going to be like, oh, man, that's great. But Siamese Dream was so much better. You know, Today is such a great song. You know, it's like it's a departure from that for sure. But yeah, it's about like the age you are when you're experiencing this stuff. Yeah, for sure. I could totally understand that.
Yeah, yeah. So for those reasons, would you say that's why it's your favorite? Or like what? Like,
uh-huh.
Yeah?
I think it's because, yeah, well, it's definitely that. I mean, I think it definitely has a lot of significance for me because of the amount of time and energy that I put into obsessing over the album. So it's like, you know, it hits you right away. Like, I remember when I first brought the album home, how excited I was to just, like, to crack it open. Because the album art alone is just something like, oh, okay, you know, this is kind of cool. It's like this, like, Renaissance painting type thing, you know, like it's a little different than what was, you know, traditionally, I guess, like a alternative or grunge cover at the time, you know. But then right away, you know, it opens with a little piano moment.
Oh, such a great intro. Yeah.
And then goes right into Tonight. I mean, like, you know, right away you're like, okay, this is not the same thing as Siamese Dream, you know.
Yeah.
Even when, like, you know, they lead off, the lead off single from the album was Bullet with Butterfly Wings, and you're like, okay, this is a little different, this is a little harder than anything on Siamese Dream, or what you thought was, you know, Smashing Pumpkins.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get two discs worth of it, you know. And then so that really just, like I said, like it kicked off this obsession with the band for me. To the point where I was really trying to track down every little piece of recording that they would put out, official or unofficial. It really marks a time, you know, when I was a teenager, had my first job, coming into the city a lot, coming to New York City a lot, to go to record stores, you know, and spending my money on records. And then part of that experience was like tracking down import singles or tracking down, you know, record or like actual like vinyl copies of Smashing Pumpkin stuff. But yeah, I mean, so much to obsess about, I think.
Where were you working during that time?
When the album came out, I was working in an Italian bakery.
Wow.
In the General Square area. So,
wait,
yeah.
This is Jersey City for those people listening. Is it the, I'm trying to think of what bakery that would be.
Monteleone's Bakery. Shout out to Monteleone's Bakery.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
I think they're still around. but yeah, I worked there during the week and then on the weekends. And then this was kind of like my tradition. Like, we get paid on Saturdays and I take that money and go right into the city, jump on the PATH train there, come to the city, and then like just go to all the record stores, you know.
Which is the way to go.
We weren't
paying rent.
I know, so exactly. That money goes straight to the pocket, or straight to the record stores, really. So that was before I was working in a record store too. But even then, when I was working in a record store, I would still, like, you know, go to that experience of going to the same stores that you went to, you know, growing up. That was a thing. So yeah, I was taking that bakery money and going to the city and then spending it on straight up albums. And so, you know, I don't know if you remember the Poster Mat too. The Poster Mat
was like my favorite store growing up.
Totally.
That was on St. Mark's Place, right?
It was 8th Street.
I think it's the Uncle Sam's. It's where my buddy works.
Okay.
And I was telling him this used to be a great store.
Yeah,
called
the Poster Mat. And then so it was that same kind of experience. Like, it wasn't just like the music that you would really get into, but it was like going down to the Poster Mat and seeing like those big Subway sized posters that they had there.
Oh yeah.
Of like melancholy art or just like, you know, things that are related to it. Like, I obsessed over every little detail of this album. Internet culture was a weird thing at the time, so, you know, like, I remember like downloading all the fonts from the album, having the fonts in my computer, or like MIDI versions of Smashing Pumpkin songs, you know. So like anything that was related to this music, you know, I was like totally drawn into.
Man,
yeah.
I definitely remember getting MIDI versions of everything I liked. Versions. Oh geez.
Yeah.
Be a big nerd.
I know.
So I'm trying to think. So did you get Rob into Smashing Pumpkins? Is that where that came from?
You know, I don't know. I think that he kind of found them on his own, but like because like we would see each other all the time, you know, I think we just fed off of each other, I guess. Because I know that like I have a feeling that he was definitely like there with like Siamese Dream for some reason. And then like Melancholy came out, and you know, we just obsessed over it, you know, on and off, like together, like every time we'd see each other, you know.
Yeah
But I mean, like, I think that was a shared experience, like everyone, like that was like a shared experience for people in their teenage
teenagers.
Yeah,
well, it's also like quick backstories. I've known you for
so long.
I'm 32, so 19 years.
Oh, man.
And you, like, one of my best friends went to high school with, and you were dating his older sister at the time. Right. So you were, like, the cool older guy we knew that would give us a quick ride to, like, West Coast Video. And would always be listening to cool music. So we're like, oh, okay, that's where we go. And that's so cool. You were that guy.
Oh, man.
You were, like, the cool dude drifting in and out. And then... I didn't see you for a couple of years. Then I bumped into you at a
basketball.
Yeah, because we were playing in the same basketball league, and the world is very small.
Look at that! How about that? I know, it's crazy. Even though, and like, you know, we're both guys that like grew up in Jersey City, but don't live in Jersey City anymore. So it's kind of nice to have another kind of Jersey City brother living in New York City.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like. It's crazy because when I moved to Jersey City, I was like, I don't want to leave New York. And then I was like, I met so many cool people. Yeah. It's like, why not?
That's right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So did you ever see them? You've seen these guys live, definitely,
yeah,
right?
I have.
Did you go to the Liberty State Park shows or something?
Oh, Liberty State. Did they play Liberty State
I thought
Park
they
show?
Did. I could be wrong.
Familiar.
I think they did.
It sounds really familiar that they did or were supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going to see Radiohead at Liberty State Park.
Okay, yeah, that one.
Yeah, these guys, you know, I do remember, you know, when they did the big Madison Square Garden tour, I guess I was like 16 when that happened. So, like, I wasn't quite, like, really going to shows yet, and I didn't go. But, like, that was a show, of course, where, like, Jimmy Chamberlain overdosed, and they had to totally, like, change the dynamic, you know, of Smashing Pumpkins from then on. So I regret never seeing that version of the band.
Yeah.
Or at least them, you know, at the height of Melancholy, which is a real bummer. But yeah, I've seen them, like, I've seen them tour Adore, and I've seen Zwan play.
I like Zwan. I don't care what anyone says. That's a fun album.
It is a fun album. And it's like, you know, it's a great group of musicians, you know, to get all those guys together. And the songs, and like, I think, you know, if people were looking for Siamese Dream type Smashing Pumpkins, Zwan is where you'd land. Zwan was the closest to it at the time, for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, like, I remember I was listening to the other one of your past episodes, the guy who was talking about Siamese Dream.
Oh, Greg Wyszynski.
Yeah. And he mentioned something from the Arising tour, that he had a shirt from the Arising tour, and I remember that because that was like the Pumpkins, like it was their like comeback tour, like it was coming off of Melancholy, and they were kind of like before Adore and after Melancholy, when they were just kind of quiet for a bit, they wanted to do a club tour around the world, or across the country at least. And the New York stop was at a place called Tramps. I don't think that exists anymore. No, it definitely does not exist anymore. But I don't know when they closed. But it was like, I guess, like, you know, maybe like a 300 or 400 person capacity venue. So it was like really like a small venue. And I really wanted to go see them. But this was also at a time where you weren't buying tickets online. You know, you were going and standing at the venue. So I remember like waking up on a Saturday morning, standing outside in a line, you know, with a bunch of people, and a bunch of people like decked out in their Smashing Pumpkins gear, thinking that I was going to get tickets, like so optimistic that I was going to get tickets, and I just totally got shut out. And that's the one I really like. I wish that I could have gotten that. I wish I could have been at that show because, you know, who wouldn't want to see this big arena band playing in a small club at the height? Like, this isn't like sad Pumpkins now. This is like the Pumpkins still coming off of like this big, you know, like 3 or 4 year tour that they were touring this double album, you know.
Yeah,
they were still like world icons, you know, music icons at the time. So
true.
Yeah, it would have been cool to see that, but whatever.
So let me ask you this. So say you take Melancholy out of the picture, so you still have Siamese Dream, Ava Adore, and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say it sticks to that timeline too. So
okay,
or maybe there's some other album that you bump an album into this same time frame. Do you think you'd still be into the Pumpkins as much, or do you think like this album was like that linchpin that got you into it?
I think you're totally right. It's this album that was the linchpin because, like, you know, I didn't obsess over anything, or I didn't obsess over much with Siamese Dream. Even with like everything after Melancholy, like Adore, like I tracked down the singles, but I didn't really, I didn't really buy as much, you know. I don't think they really put out as much, and that's, I think that says a lot, that like if you remove Melancholy and everything they did for Melancholy, you're removing like hours of music from their catalog.
That's
and
true,
like, you
yeah.
know, like almost like 100 tracks really from their entire catalog. So like, you know, there's less to obsess about even at that point. So yeah, I think that like if this particular era never happened, I probably wouldn't be the same kind of Pumpkins fan, or I don't think it would have resonated with me the same way that all this did, for sure. Yeah.
Do you think that have a big impact on your life almost, like, or like what you like got into and everything like that?
No, you're totally right. I mean, I think so, because like, you know, I was playing a lot more music at the time, and I know that like just the style of guitar playing, the way I'd strum a guitar, like it was definitely like ripped straight from Melancholy, or ripped straight from the ways that Billy Corgan played the guitar, you know. So like Billy Corgan, you know, I hate to say it, but he was like in my teenage years like a big musical influence, you know, not necessarily lyrically but like more musically, you know. So like I think that I would be playing music different, you know, if I didn't get that into this, or maybe I wouldn't say that I wouldn't get into the same kinds of music. Like I think everyone eventually finds the music that they like.
Oh, definitely.
I think things would definitely be a lot different had I not come across Melancholy, or had they not done Melancholy, for sure. Who knows what that band would have turned into. And it's kind of amazing too that like you know, this was a full band effort,
yeah,
more so than Siamese Dream was. So like, you know, you can't really necessarily say the same about Adore. Maybe you could say the same for Machina. I don't know, but that's the thing. Like I didn't care too much.
It's like, yeah. I don't think I really listened to any of their albums after Melancholy with the same kind of like attention.
That's right.
You know, it's like, all right, I'll give it a listen. I'm not really into it.
Exactly.
I think the last like new song of theirs was like, all right, was the one off the Batman Forever soundtrack.
Oh man, it's so good, bro. It is so good. And then they did, oh man, there was a movie that came out not too long ago that used like a slowed down version of that song from the Batman soundtrack.
Yes.
Was it like Inception or something?
Oh, it was something. One of those movies. Crap.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, wow, this is going to bring this song back. This is going to bring back the Pumpkins big time.
Oh, man, that's gonna drive me insane now.
It's so good.
I definitely remember that because I was like, wait, what am I listening to?
Yeah, exactly. And that's like, I guess that kind of tucks into the same period of the Pumpkins too, because they had that song and then they had that song off of the Lost Highway soundtrack. It was like EYE.
Okay.
And it was like, you know, like another kind of like it, all these songs that sit really nicely next to 1979. I think that's where it got really interesting, because like, I remember like when this album came out, Billy Corgan in interviews would say things like, you know, 1979, that's the direction that we're going in, you know, like that's a single that's going to stick out for them. And sure enough, like, you know, it was one of the first songs that really showcased like their kind of like new wave influences, or at least to this degree, with this kind of polish. And then, you know, their drummer overdoses, you know, they're forced to work without a drummer, and because of that they can really start to explore a lot of their new wave influences a lot more. But like the single, the stuff that they packed on the single, it's just perfect. It sounds like something out of a Joy Division, you know, or like they were covering Joy Division songs, you know. Nice. James Iha covered a Cure song, you know, as one of the B-sides, or one of the box set B-sides.
it's funny you say that. Have we ever told you the story? One of the guys in the crew, he has a reputation for any time Love Will Tear Us Apart by Joy Division plays, like if we'd be like at Lit Lounge when it was still going on,
oh man,
and it'd be playing and he'd be talking to a girl, he goes, I'd love The Cure. And we just sit back and laugh, we just know. And it got to the point where if I was intoxicated enough, I'd like walk behind him and I'd be like, it's not The Cure. Like, I'm sorry to blow up your spot, but it's not.
Oh man,
I'll tell you who it is when we're done recording.
Okay.
But
yeah.
Also, like, I'm just trying to think of like all the ways this album brought people in, and the videos too.
Yeah, the videos.
So like,
for sure,
they were very different from each other.
Yeah,
but they were all really good.
You're totally right. I just not too long ago, I watched the 33 video, And I thought, like, how does a song like this get radio play? And how does a video like this show up on MTV? Like, they were getting away with it because they were like, you know, it's like for that period of time, like the art school kids were cool. You know, everyone wanted to like, you know, everyone wanted to be a part of that movement. And you can get away with putting this weird kind of stop motion-esque type video with a song that had no drums on it. It's all acoustic guitar. You know, it's like this mid-tempo acoustic sad song, I guess, you know. And you can just get away with it. Yeah. But like the video is just, it's so weird. It's like, this is something that was on MTV at the time. Okay. You know, that's cool. They're just sitting on a bed, all introspective. Like,
yeah.
But yeah, the videos for sure. I guess, you know, I really don't know how significant music videos are for music audiences these days. But
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no main outlet. I mean, yeah, people will be like, oh, we just released a new video, go to YouTube. But yeah. Remember, we had channels where you could just sit there all day and be like, let's watch this.
That's right. You know? That's right. That's right.
And like, another weird thing I think about with this is, like, the content of the songs and everything, like, I feel you could come at it different ways depending on, like, say, especially if you're in high school, if you're in a relationship,
yeah,
or if you're not in a relationship,
that's true.
It can be like two completely different things.
That's right.
It's like, whoa.
I know. Well, that's a thing. I mean, like, I think that, like, you know, I know that I did this, and I'm sure like teenagers around the world did this, just like scribbling, you know, Billy Corgan lyrics, you know, on like notebooks and all that. You know, it's like it's like grunge emo. You know, it's like totally just like, you know, attaching yourself to these like words. You're like, oh, so sad. You know, oh, she loves me, she doesn't love me. You know, kind of thing. I'm so alone.
Yeah. Did you put Lily on any mixtapes?
No. That's a good one though.
Because Rob, I remember Rob was always, he's like, Lily, man, that's the song.
I bet he did. He love that song. You're right. Those songs, for real, like, you know, this kind of shows how dynamic this album is. Like, there is this breakdown on that part of the album, the last half of the second disc of the album, where it's like Lily and We Only Come Out at Night. Like, these are like the things where, like, Billy Corgan was talking about, like, 1979 is the direction they're going in. Like, those songs are the indication of it, you know, where it is like these kind of like, you know, like drum machine songs and a lot more synth and a lot more slow and steady paced songs, you know. It's weird that you can include four songs like that right after, you know, I think the song before it was just like this like 8 minute opus, you know, that like just like was Billy Corgan shredding, and then you go right into a drum machine song. It's really peculiar, but, you know, somehow they pulled it off. It's kind of fascinating for sure. Yeah
Follow up to an earlier question. This is probably the first episode where I've had this many questions about the album.
There's so much to talk about.
Oh man. Yeah. So we were talking about what if this hadn't come along at that time. What if this album came out right now, the age you are at now?
Oh, that's really,
do you think it'd resonate as well? Because musically, it holds up. Like, you know, there's some albums where you're like, this came out when I was a kid or whatever, and I still enjoy it. But, you know, musically, it's not a thing that would grab me. But because of the nostalgia factor and just remembering where I was, I can, you know. But what if this came out, like, you know, this year?
Well, that's a good point. You know, I don't know. I mean, like, it's tough to try to, you know, shift around like where you would be, you know, if this wasn't introduced in your
true
life, teenage years. But I think that, like, I don't know if someone was this prolific right now, and it kind of exists. It must exist. I couldn't tell you a artist these days that's putting out work at the same kind of both quantity and quality of work that these guys were doing at the time. But you know, I don't know, like, you know, in your 30s, do you really have time to go down to the record stores? Well, even right now in 2015, what record stores are you going to? You have two or three record stores in the city, in an entire city.
I actually texted the guys back in Jersey. I was like, what was the name of the record store in Journal Square? Because that's where I bought this album, Music Station.
That's right.
I was like,
the record store in Journal Square. Wow, I used to buy cassette singles from there all the time.
Yep.
Wow. Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, it's like, when you obsess over things these days, it involves you sitting in front of a computer and looking at all this stuff. So yeah, you know, maybe the way they would have released this stuff would have been different now. I don't know. Like, I think that, like, I don't have the same kind of experiences with music digitally that I do physically. You know, it's like, even like, you know, I can remember, for instance, like going back to the 1979 single, I could remember going into the HMV at 34th Street and then going straight to the import single section and going right to the S's and looking for Smashing Pumpkins. You know, I remember that part of the experience. And it's a lot different than, you know, someone telling me about a song and me, someone chatting me, you know, messaging me about a song. And then on that same device, I'm going to a browser window and searching YouTube for that song or searching Spotify for that song. And it's a totally different experience. And, you know, you remove a lot of like the human factor from it. And I don't know, for me, I think that gives it less reason to stick around or less reason to be nostalgic about it.
Yeah.
Because it's just kind of like this cold and sure, it has its own meaning, but the meaning is different and it's not, it doesn't hold the same way that it does when you're actually like, you know, like physically in a space, the smells, the people that you encounter, you know, remembering that it's a winter day, you know, and then like, you know, you had just come from your bakery job, you know, so you smell like Italian pastries, you know, and you got a wad of 20s in your pocket.
Yeah. And I mean, I also feel like with Spotify and everything, it would totally destroy everything this album has, mainly because... Yeah. So say I started and I'm like, this intro is cool, and then Tonight starts playing, I'm like, whoa, this reminds me. I can just type it in and start listening to the song. Right. It reminds me instantly.
Right.
So like I feel like it's very rare when you actually sit through a whole album.
Yeah.
Like something new, you're like, all right, I'll listen to this all at once, you know.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's a thing. It's like, I think it's also very obvious to me, at least using Spotify or things like Spotify, that like people don't build these apps to the album listening habits, you know, that very rarely do people actually listen to an entire album, I guess. So it's exactly that. Like, you know, you don't have that experience where you're like, oh man, I'm going to listen to the new Smashing Pumpkins album. You're just picking around through songs. Although, you know, I say this and like, you know, we're just coming off of a day where like Rihanna's new album is everyone's talking about today. Like she like,
yeah, it's the whole thing. Music industry is so weird to me now. It's like, what, who,
yeah, who,
how,
albums,
yeah,
title,
yeah,
what's title?
I don't remember anything anymore. It's sad. It's really really sad.
Yeah, it's not the same, that's for sure.
Yeah,
but you make it work for you, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, I'll just sit there and I'll just listen to a ton of music and I'm like, yep, you get lost in it.
No,
there's
totally.
So much, you know?
Well, I will say that, like, you know, they've been doing all of these reissues of these Smashing Pumpkins albums now. If you thought that there was a lot of music written during Melancholy, then, you know, take a look at the reissues of both Melancholy and the Aeroplane Flies High box set. They added, like, hundreds and hundreds of songs, unearthed tracks, you know, different mixes of these songs. So there's like really like hundreds of songs out there like the label put them out, you know. So these are like fully endorsed, authorized versions of the songs. And of course, like I'd rather not spend $100 on these, not at all. Like on $100 on CDs in 2015, 2016, no thanks.
Yeah.
But they were all on Apple Music, so like during that 3-month trial period of Apple Music, where it was like free Apple Music for 3 months, I was listening to all of the stuff from both Melancholy, all of the unearthed tracks, and like it was my only experience of it. And you know, I briefly for a slight period of time, I considered going out and buying them just because I heard it all on Apple Music. So sometimes they do work in your favor, these streaming services, I guess.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. It's like I'm gonna save myself some cash.
That's right.
Why not?
Yeah.
So are you still making music on the side or
not so much these days?
Really?
I know. It's like, I don't know, I guess you get older, inspiration's different or different kinds of inspiration. You just don't have the time, I guess. I don't know.
Life, man.
Life happens.
Yeah,
life happens.
It's weird that we're old enough that's a thing, you know?
I know. It happens, huh?
On the Beatles podcast I do with Pete, we were just talking about, like, you know, music we released, we recorded as kids and stuff, and it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
that was fun. And then everyone became, you know, too busy and yep. it just all ended.
Families and babies. Yeah. Now, I remember that when you guys were playing too. And
it was fun.
Garages. I loved it. I loved recording music at home. I loved playing in bands for a little bit. You know, it's just like, and it's like, you know, it ties in directly with the music you're listening to. Like, I remember like when I played in a band with a couple of friends, I sent them like 5 songs that I really like, being like, this is the kind of music I think we should be playing, you know? And it's so like, you know, your favorite music kind of ties directly into that music playing experience. And it's kind of sad that when that part of your life gets removed, you know, and you're not playing music anymore.
Yeah,
here and there, I'll strum a guitar, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I'll goof around with like a bass in the that I have in the closet. But
right.
My 2 guitars are just like probably just full, covered in dust. It's so sad, you know?
Yeah.
But okay, life. So you got all your physical copies of this. Do you still have a large physical collection of music?
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it goes back to the, like, liking the physical experience of listening to music. So, like, you know, I worked in a record store for...
Was that WoW?
That was WoW Music. Shout out to WoW Music in Jersey City, R.I.P.
Oh, man. Hudson Mall.
You know, we dealt in used CDs there. So, like, I bought tons and tons of CDs while I was there. And so in my apartment, I've carried this to over the course of 3 apartments now, 3 or 4 apartments, this entire wall of CDs. So it's like, I don't know. I don't have a count on how many CDs there are, but I do know that it takes up an entire wall.
That's awesome.
And so, like, you know, for a period of time, I thought it was just going to be, like, something to look at. But no, I engage with this wall every day. Like, my routine in the morning is staring at this wall of CDs and picking out a CD to listen to and putting it in a stereo, you know, actually putting it in the stereo and queuing it up to listen to in the morning as I'm getting ready. And anytime I'm at home, you know, it's a CD or a record, but, like, you know, it's that experience of, like, thumbing through stuff, you know, physically seeing like all of these albums in front of you, picking the one you want, taking it out of the wall, putting it in a CD player or putting a you know, record on a turntable, you know, it's that experience. Like, it's just, it's a lot more meaningful. Like, I know that like when you just like queue up a bunch of songs in like Spotify or something, you're less engaged with it. And, you know,
yeah.
It's almost like background music. I know like during the day, like I'm just listening to Spotify all day and it's just stuff that I have queued up, you know,
definitely
not necessarily me picking something out, you know?
Yeah. And then every once in a while it'll catch you. You're like, wait, what was that song?
Yeah,
whoa,
exactly.
I'm going to go back and get into that.
Exactly. That happens all the time. You're like, oh man, like I totally forgot about this Rentals album, you know, the Rentals, you know.
I love the Rentals.
Oh, that was so good.
I got to see them live once and it was so good.
It's like, that album, that first album there is came out just around the same time as Melancholy.
Yeah, like
crazy.
Right, yeah.
Oh, 20 plus years ago.
That's horrible.
No, I'm sorry.
That much time has passed. I was a young man.
Oh, I know.
I was living my life and I guess I wasn't doing much.
No, there's not really much.
Yeah, I'm gonna. I don't know, man. I don't know. So, if you could compare this album to anything, now I'm just making up questions.
Okay. Yeah.
If like you can compare this album to like, you know, whatever.
Uh huh.
In a way to describe what this is to you, what would you?
Oh man. To me, it's like it really is like kind of like in a way. I think the way I obsessed over it is just like, you know, being in a relationship, like the way you would obsess over like a girlfriend, you know. It's like I wanted to know everything that these guys were doing and I wanted to be a part of it, and you know, like I wanted to own it, I wanted to cover my walls in it, I wanted to buy the t-shirts, you know, I wanted to scribble lyrics in notebooks, I wanted to write music like it, you know. It was like I wanted to be a part of this experience. So like I keep coming back to the word obsessive with this because that's really what I did at the time. Like, I really, really obsessed over this. Like, I can't even... it's this thing that still kind of sticks with me, too. Like, even, you know, I think we've been talking about doing this for your podcast for a bit.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, like, I would try to prepare and just, like, I'd stop preparing because I'm like, I could talk about this album and everything it did forever. Like I could keep going, you know, because that's how much I obsessed over it, you know. That's how much I lived through this like over and over and over again. I think it's like being in that kind of like It's like anything that you get obsessive over, you know, if like you're really into a sports team, you know, the band was some, this band, this particular period of the band was something to obsess over. And it's like, it's the other thing. It's like, you know, there are a lot of artists that had prolific periods or get like the word prolific attached to them, you know, but they don't really, they might pump out a lot of albums, but it's not the same quality. It's not like a Guided by Voices thing where like, you know, and I love Guided by Voices, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when Robert Pollard's putting out like 5 albums a year, you know, he really could have just done some editing, you know, and put out one or even like 2. I'd say he could do 2 quality albums a year. And like did it with Ryan Adams too. Like Ryan Adams had that one period where he like put out 5 albums in like over the course of the year. And like most of it was junk, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The Smashing Pumpkins and Billy Corgan, they were putting out that same quantity of work, but it was really well edited. Like they really were careful about how they did it. And I think that makes the experience a lot more memorable.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're not like, as a customer, as a fan, you're not feeling burnt by like, you know, and I get this in the record store all the time where someone like, you know, is shelling their money down for something and they're like, ugh, you know, half these songs are terrible.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
When you're spending, you know, $10 on an import CD, you know that like, and the experience is good. You love all the songs, you know, it's going to keep you coming back, you know, you want to continue experiencing all this stuff. So like, you know, their image was very calculated, but the quality of the music too was just well edited.
You know,
they knew what the right balance was for the album, for each of the singles. The experience was just like many experiences for sure, but obsession is what it was. And I tell you, like, this 1979 single, you know, it's including 1979, that's 6 songs, right? And 6 solid songs. I think one of my favorite Smashing Pumpkin songs of all time is on the 19. It's the last song on the 1979 single. But if you took that single and you took those 4 songs from the second disc of Melancholy that kind of sound like 1979, you'd have like 10 songs.
You'd have
like,
an album.
You'd have an album. You have a perfect album. Just that on its own, I think it's like the kind of like book in a sense, like, you know, the fan mix or the fan lost Smashing Pumpkins album, the fan made Smashing Pumpkins album. But like you play those 10 songs, you start off with 1979, you play the rest of the 9 songs. That album is like better than what a lot of people like wish they could do. You know, it's crazy. It's crazy that's the quality of the work that they're putting out at the time.
Now I have to ask you this.
Yeah.
Dawn to Dusk or Twilight to Starlight? If you could only pick one.
Oh, man.
You can't make any alterations and be like, well, if you toss this track
That's tough.
Have to pick one.
I would have to say Twilight to Starlight.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, because that's a second. Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
I have to make sure that's it. It's kind of like... it really like hits you. Like the first track alone is just this kind of like starts off with like that like riff, that like distorted riff, and then it, like it really just jumps into and that song, by the way,
Bodies is great.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Second track, like,
I think that's the
Love Is Suicide one, right?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. And so that's the thing. I think like if you just package that album, that disc as a single album, and like probably erase the entire first album, it still would hold pretty well. I bet you know they probably would have gotten better reviews for the album at the time, if because you know people like to throw around criticism anytime someone throws out a double album.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, they could have trimmed this down to one album.
True, true.
People like, and you know, people thought that Billy Corgan was a real asshole too, and like just really full of himself when he did that. So I don't know. Whatever the case was, yeah, second disc all the way.
Wow,
no question.
Okay, yeah, I was curious. I was trying to figure out which way I'd go with that, and I was like, I would imagine I would have thought I'd go first one easily.
Yeah.
But I was like, man, there's some great songs on that, too.
Yeah. It seems like the pacing, I guess, or just the way the sequence is for the second disc is really solid. Like, you know, it comes in with the heavy songs, and then, like, they have, like, these nice, like, 33 is the 3rd song, Stumbleen's the 8th song, you know? It's like you have the chill moments in there. Oh, yeah. Wow. That's a great question. I never really thought of it that way.
Like, I like trying to throw people for a loop, but you responded very quickly. You didn't even stutter, really.
Yeah,
like, yeah,
no,
I got it. No, we're good.
That's totally it. You could totally work. I don't know if that's a psychological thing too, like, you know, because your last taste of the album is the second disc, you know,
yeah.
That's a thing that's stuck in your head.
Very true.
I don't know. I think it front to back, it's a good one.
I remember for a while I lost, I think, the first disc.
Oh no.
For I don't know where it was. And then I actually ended up like in my mom's closet, because one day she was like cleaning. She's like, is this yours? And I was like, yes.
There it is.
Where was that?
Dawn to Dusk.
For years. It was just in her closet.
So you had no choice but to listen to that second
disc. Yeah, I was just like, yeah, we're just going to chill with this one.
And it's still good enough.
Heck yeah. Yeah. It's like all about it.
Yeah.
So now I got to ask the hard question.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a lot of songs here.
Yeah.
For the playlist I have on Spotify for this show,
uh-huh.
You know, we ask everyone, pick a track.
Sure.
Could be your favorite or something you think will bring people in.
Sure.
Or... actually, I think I already know your answer to this, but go ahead. Let's.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be off of this 1979 single.
Oh, you know? Okay.
Because, like, I think it's, like, one of the great underheard songs of the Smashing Pumpkins that... it, underheard because it was tucked away as the last song as a B-side on, you know... arguably their biggest single,
mm-hmm.
Or their biggest hit rather from the album, but it's the song "Set the Rate of Jerry."
Okay,
I think you could find that on Spotify. There's like this weird compilation album that has just like hundreds of songs on it on Spotify. But "Set the Rate of Jerry," it's a quality Smashing Pumpkins song. Very like it's like a. Like, it's a really open song, you know, for all of the music that they did where it was just like layers and layers of guitar. This is a very open song, and it's still a very well-written song, too. And so, like, you know, I think, if anything, because it's so, I think, underappreciated or hasn't really been heard, that, you know, more people need to discover this song. Because, you know, like, you know, who really goes and tries to track down singles and B-sides from singles? You know, not a lot of people.
Yeah, it's kind of a lost art, actually.
It is a lost art.
That's
sad. It's a lost art, I know.
And you're the first guest who's actually... included all the B-sides and stuff. Like,
well,
I like it.
That is the period for them. The period was like, because, you know, all of these B-sides were recorded from those same sessions from Melancholy, or, you know, maybe they weren't completed, but they all had their beginnings, you know, from the Melancholy sessions. So they're really much all kind of in the same musical vein. You know, or they all have the same tones. They all have the same touch points. You know, to where they are, where they were creatively. I'll also say this about the 1979 single, because I don't think it's something that gets appreciated either. James Iha has two songs on the 1979 single, and not only does he have two songs, but they're two of the best songs he's ever done, ever. So you know, like. That's why, like, this single has everything, you know? It has, like, it has two James Iha songs that happen to be the best songs he's ever done, you know? It has just this very consistent mood to it that all kind of, like, you know, makes sense packaging with 1979. And then it has that killer song at the end. Like, I think that's, like, you know, if that entire single is on Spotify or could be put on a playlist, I would do that. And then I would throw those four songs in from Melancholy. Those
just
four 1979 type
songs. Have your own album. You should just put that
unofficial
out there.
Album.
There you go. You call it the Moon Cut.
That's right. The J Moon Cut. Unofficial.
It'd be set.
Yeah. There it is.
There you go. So what would you say is the lasting legacy of this album? And what words would you say for anyone who hasn't, for some reason, has never listened to this album? Because this album was everywhere, man.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to come across someone who's not aware of this, or, like, maybe, like, four of the singles that were everywhere.
Yeah, it's true. The lasting legacy of the album, I think it's that it was probably the last time in Billy Corgan's career that he was this... active at such working at such a high pace. Like, this is like LeBron James or Michael Jordan in their prime, you know. It's like, this is him really just knocking down his 50 point games, his 60 point games, you know. It's like it's really him putting out so much work creatively and just knocking it out of the park over and over and over again. So, like, if there's any kind of a period where you would look to see where you could pick out where Billy Corgan was the most, was the closest to, like, an artist, a great artist, however you define a great artist, you know, it's this period, you know. Because, again, like, Siamese Dream was a great album, you know. Gish was a great album. But none of them really showed how active Billy Corgan was as a musician, as an artist, and how much... they could actually get done as a band together.
Yeah.
You know, this was also like, I think Melancholy was the was a real true band effort as well, where they were working collaboratively.
Yeah.
You know, which was way different than Siamese Dream, where it's just like Billy Corgan and Jimmy Chamberlain doing the whole thing. On Melancholy, not only did they all work together, but James Iha has some songs on there. He has a lot of songs on there. So, like, you know, this was the peak of their creativity for sure. And, you know, it's made appearances here and there. I'd actually say this new Smashing Pumpkins album that came out in, I think, 2014, it's actually pretty good.
No, I haven't listened to it yet.
The one before that isn't that good, the Zeitgeist one.
Oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah.
But this new one is really good. Tommy Lee plays the drums on it.
Really?
Yeah, you got to check it out.
All right, I'm going to have to give it a listen.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know what you say to someone who hasn't heard this album. Like, listen to it. If you really want to, you know, if you want to hear one of the great artists of our time at their peak, this is the album to jump into. If you want to hear their biggest hits, go listen to Siamese Dream, you know. But if you really
want, you think their hits on Siamese Dream are bigger than their hits on this?
Oh yeah.
Really?
People are going to stick with Today forever. People love Today.
That's true.
And Disarm, yeah. I guess Disarm was like, you
Disarm
know.
Oh, it's yeah okay, I guess
those, I think if you walk to anyone like our age, if you walked up to them and you asked them name the first Smashing Pumpkins song that you can think of, Today would probably be up there, I'd say.
Okay. I could see Tonight being there, though,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, maybe even Bullet with Butterfly Wings, because that got played so much at the time. But, yeah, I think that, like, if you're looking for, like, their, like, kind of, like, I think that Siamese Dream was their pop album.
Yeah.
You know, and Melancholy was definitely, like, their art album, their art rock album.
Yeah.
Even though there was very, like, it's, like, pop art rock, really. But, like, you know, it's, like, when you're comparing the two, like, this is definitely the edgier of the album, and it just so many good songs on there.
Yeah, well, I was reading, he said something, he kind of like wanted to make their white album.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Let's go for it.
Yeah, to right down to like ending it with like a song called Goodnight or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's like how the white album ends too. No, it's totally true. I mean, like if that's what they were going for, like I think that they really did succeed to a certain point, you know. It's a double album that debuted at number one on the Billboard charts. You know, I mean, like that doesn't happen a lot. I don't think people put out double albums anymore.
Yeah, probably not.
I don't know.
Who knows? I don't keep track.
They put out a single every week. That's what they do.
Oh man, dude, I'm glad we finally got to do this.
Yeah, seriously. And man, yeah, you're going to have to, you have to cut me off because.
No.
I could keep talking about this forever.
I'd love it, man. I've always enjoyed nerding out about music with people,
man.
And you know, this is great.
Yeah.
This is 19 years in the making.
19 years in the making.
I remember being 13 years old and going, if I have a podcast, Johnny Moon's going to be on it.
And that album he's always listening to?
Yep.
That's the one.
That's what we're going to go with.
That's the one.
Yeah. You got any last things you want to squeeze in?
No. I'll tell you, with the obsessions also come, you know, moments of regret. And I think that this hit me as I was reading up on the album today. The one memory that I have of this album that really makes me just kick myself to this day is not buying the album on vinyl during its original pressing when I had the chance. And this was something that I really did. Like I said, like I went to the city, go to the record stores on Saturdays after working at the bakery. And I remember very clearly one Saturday going into Bleecker Street Records, back when it was on Bleecker Street.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is crazy. I didn't even know they moved it. Anyway, I remember going to Bleecker Street Records, seeing the album, the vinyl copy of the album there on the rack, and it was like something like $20 or $25, and I was like, I don't want to carry that home. I'll come back and I'll pick it up another time. And sure enough, you know, it was like limited to like 5,000. And these were like numbered copies too. And so like in like the years after that, I remember like it always stuck with me, like, oh man, I really wish I picked up that album on vinyl when I saw it. And then you monitor eBay prices and they're going like in the hundreds. You know, that's how rare that album was. And I had it in my hands and I was like, nah, I'll come back and get this some other time. So like, as much as this was a big obsession of mine, it also comes with one of my biggest regrets.
Oh.
My biggest record buying regrets of all time, not buying that. So it's kind of happy and sad.
Sorry, man.
Stories, yeah.
Oh, that's.
But here we are. Whatever.
Maybe, you know, next time it kind of prepares you in case you get like an opportunity like that and you're on the fence, be like, no.
Exactly.
I gotta buy
it now because who knows.
That's crazy, nope. Dude.
That's what happens. Man. No regrets, though. No regrets.
Well, thanks, Johnny Moon.
Thank you, for, Adam. This is fun.
Being on the show. You got anything you want to share? I always ask people. Yeah. I don't know. People got events. Do they still do that trivia thing or whatever?
What trivia? The Met?
Yeah. Do they still do
that? We've got one probably coming up in the spring. R21 I need to
go to that. Can you give a quick explanation of what that is?
We've done this now. R21, the organization I work for, and the Metropolitan Museum, their Spectrum Group, we get together and we host a bar style trivia night at the Met in the springtime, and you know, it's a lot of like art and pop culture and the crossover of the two, and just like, you know, it's a really fun trivia event, and we do it definitely in the style of trivia, bar trivia. It's an open bar all night. It's a ticketed event, but it's an open bar all night, so it's kind of fun. I mean, like, we have a lot of fun writing these questions, and like we do the things. We have like a video round, we have visual rounds and audio rounds, and we try to make it accessible. You know, you don't have to be an art kind of snob to have fun at these events. So. This year will probably be the fourth or fifth year that we're doing it together at the Met.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely need to check it out. Yeah. No, definitely.
I'll share that with you. Springtime.
Nice, nice. But yeah, man, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a lot of fun.
I want to thank everyone for listening to me and Johnny Moon talk about some Smashing Pumpkins. If you've never heard it, seriously, go out and listen to Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness. And like Johnny Moon said, the track is Set the Ray to Jerry off the 1979 single. He went for this single. No one's done that yet. There's a first for everything, but that's awesome. You can get to the playlist on Spotify, or you can go from the website, yourfavoritealbum.com. We're also on Twitter. We're on Facebook, all that stuff. You know, feel free to check it out. We'll be back again, you know, eventually. I've been keeping on schedule this year. I'm trying, you know. But yeah, thanks for listening, everybody. Until next time, have a good one. Bye.
Bye.